The Totally Torture edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a whine about torture police and why I have no plans to go to the US, and web wisdom about torture and the militarization of the police. Let's begin episode 278.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello, tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about Christmas, and the holiday season in general. Well, I say holiday season, but for people like me, it's the retail season. The time of year people try and outspend the Joneses. And don't think this is a total condemnation of the season. No, my focus is really on the hyper-consumerism that we all experience this time of year. And again, just to throw you a curveball, I'm not even complaining about the I must buy mentality. No, but as someone associated with retail sales, my lament about this season is the toll it takes on those workers in retail. Every store at this time of year is understaffed, and newly hired seasonal staff is often undertrained, and everybody is super, super busy. And I'm afraid that it will affect you, my loyal listeners. As you already know, Radio Free Thinker has become my solo effort. As such, I have done my best to provide as good and as fair a presentation of information, commentary, and activism, all with a scientifically skeptical tint, well, as good as I'm able to. Well, the show will continue, so don't worry, this is not one of those speeches, but alas, for the next few shows over the holiday season, they will be a tad light of my own personal content and hard-hitting commentary. I will be back with shows packed full of great material and information in the new year. That said, my real whine is about torture, and more specifically, how it is now seen not as an absolute never-to-be-done crime, but as a policy decision. We have all bore witness to the revelation of abuse of prisoners, suspects, and people mistakenly apprehended by nothing more than chance, and how, with premeditated and planned intent, the U.S. government practiced torture, and practiced they did, over and over and over again. I remember a time when one of the things that was used to show the savagery, the inhumanity of some people, the uncivilized nature of regimes like the Nazis and the mythical Red Communists was their willingness to use torture. Well, it seems that we can now classify the CIA with the KGB and the Gestapo. That the US and the Nazis are not so much different in kind, but perhaps quantity. It had also been plainly made clear that no actionable information was derived from this torture, that even the most ardent defenders of this barbaric activity have had to convolute the facts to provide at best a tissue of defense. One argument in support of torture, and I should point out that this is the only case that even comes close to providing cover, no one can point really to a better or even remotely sustainable example that torture did provide any intelligence. The case in question was the name of a courier who delivered messages to bin Laden. Everyone acknowledged that they knew who this person was from regular investigative methods. But the pro-torture people say that the torture helped pick this needle out of all the haystacks of intelligence they had. I think what they meant, that it was chance. It is also widely known in the intelligence community that torture is not a good way to gain information because so much of what the interrogated says is false information. And not false in that they make it up, but that at a certain point, the tortured will say whatever they think the torturer wants to hear. So one must wonder, how many straws were followed because, thanks to torture, they thought they were the needles? If you get my point, for this one success, if we can call it that, there seems to have been hundreds of false leads. And before we think ourselves so much superior to our Yankee neighbors, well, there are a lot of evidence that our own RCMP and similar agencies participated in these activities. But unlike our southern friends, they had the decency, can I use that term? No, I think cunning is a better word. Well, it seems that Canadians have outsourced the torture by having suspects deported Or what is that harmlessly sounding term that they invented? Oh yes, rendition, a term that means kidnapped and tortured. Well, we have had at least three people, according to CBC reports, maybe more people were rendered, to places like Syria and Libya, when they are tacit friends of convenience. Well, I'm not sure what I can say. I think it's funny, in a very sad and depressing way. Like, you know, when you laugh at a funeral? Well, the Americans, and notably the Nobel Peace Prize winning Barack Hussein Obama, noting the ironic link to Saddam in his middle name, anyhow, they have said that it is a public sign of their moral strength that they have examined this dark period of U.S. activity and made it public. There's so much wrong with that. First, it only came to light after a tooth and nail fight with the administration to have the report published, and even then, only the summary has been released, and that redacted to death. In fact, it was only things like the threat by Senator Mark Udall of Colorado, soon to be former senator, to read the complete report to the Senate and thus making a public document. Only under extreme duress was any of it made public. And then there's the fact that no one is being held accountable. According to international law, torture is a crime and must be prosecuted. The U.S. is often one of the loudest to condemn nations like Iran, North Korea, China, the Nazis for their use of torture. Well, it seems that waterboarding is on the other foot now. And Obama sees this as merely a teaching moment. The UN has called for prosecutions to take place. U.S. law calls for prosecutions. Moral people call for prosecutions. And yet, there'll be none. At the start of Obama's term, one might sort of excuse him. That is, he might have thought that if he gave the Republican Bush administration a pass on torture, well, that might help buy him some goodwill with Republicans in Congress. Well, we see now how that's turned out. It's been a total bunkus. The Republicans have done nothing but been obstructionist, and Obama's gained nothing from it. So now, with the benefit of 6 years of Republican hostility and the impetus of this report, will Obama proceed with prosecutions? No. Why? Because he's a weak and poor president. Hey, don't get me wrong. I doubt, well, it's probable, that I would have done no better. He was elected president at a unique period of time in U.S. history. Never in the history of the U.S. has a Congress, an opposition party, taken such a stance and become, what is that term? Oh yes, the party of no. The current Republicans care about nothing, not even the nation they supposedly love and serve. If Obama supports it, they must be against it. But I digress. So Obama is not going to prosecute, and that's negligent. Not only because it shows a moral weakness, but it creates a precedent that a president of the U.S. can break the law and have no concern about facing justice. Even Nixon was subjugated to a presidential pardon, a backhanded admission that he broke the law and would likely have been sent to jail without the pardon. And maybe we can learn from that event. Perhaps the fact that Nixon, who we now know was involved in acts that would have likely put him in jail, with the pardoning of him, was that the first step in making the presidency above the law that was sort of taken, and Obama is just sort of taking that next logical step? Well, I don't think so. I take that back a bit. Or maybe I should say the most recent precedent on this was Iran-Contra. For those who don't know, Iran-Contra was a scandal that happened in the 80s. Reagan, desperate to fund terrorists who were attacking the socialist government in Nicaragua, well, he broke several laws in trying to support them. You see, the government of Nicaragua, duly elected under a UN-supervised elections, well, they had managed to sway the U.S. Congress to pass a law saying that it was illegal for the U.S. government to fund terrorists attacking Nicaragua, the Contras, who were actually puppets of the CIA. At the time, the U.S. had also enacted an embargo on Iran because, well, the whole hostage-taking thing. Reagan, desperate to support the Contras, arranged several arms sales to Iran at a huge profit, then funneling those profits to the Contras. This plot was discovered, and it was not swept under the carpet. No. No one said, "We learned our lesson, you can all go." No, people went to jail. And to be fair, Reagan didn't go to jail because he claimed he didn't know anything about this. And considering at the time he was suffering from Alzheimer's, it's plausible he didn't. But still, there was legal justice. Not so now. In fact, One of the disturbing shifts in the scandal is the shift of the classification of torture from being a crime to being public policy. By framing it that way, it leaves open the idea that in the future, any administration may think such an undertaking of such a policy worth pursuing, and not a criminal activity, which it is. You know, on a sort of related note, you know, I was about to renew my passport, just in case I wanted to journey south of the border. But then I thought, why would I? Sure, there are some retail opportunities, cultural events, just to be a tourist and look around. Well, I'm not so sure it would have been worth the risk. I've talked before about the state of gun control, well, uncontrol really, in the U.S. How people are shot and killed on a daily basis. Couple that with recent events surrounding the Ferguson shooting, the death of Eric Garner in New York, the 12-year-old boy shot in the park playing cops and robbers in Cleveland, the use of a flashbang grenade that landed in a baby's crib and severely injured the baby, all to exercise a search warrant, and someone shot at Walmart for the crime of carrying around a BB gun sold at the store. Well, the list seems endless. There are so many things. And how overtly brutal, lethal are the police in the U.S.? Well, it makes one think long and hard. Okay, I know I'm not black or really any kind of noticeable minority. In the U.S., being an atheist or even a skeptic can make you a target of persecution. That doesn't single me out like my skin color would. Although I may get a pass on the worst of the racism in the U.S., when you look at the authorities' response to the protests in Ferguson over the local tragedy, it is a response of military magnitude to a civilian protest. Military-styled riot gear, armored vehicles, a sniper scanning the peaceful crowds. Let me repeat that again. A sniper was scanning the crowd. One can only assume to take out who? What were they expecting? If you had a chance to listen to Officer Wilson's testimony in the Ferguson event, you would have heard him describe Brown as a superhuman monster, a demon. It is clear that the police officers, irrespective of color, no longer see themselves as peace officers, but as law enforcement agents. You see a heavily armed paramilitary, at least quasi-military force that no longer sees the citizens of the nation as something to protect, but as some kind of evil monster waiting to pounce and kill them. Cattle that must be made to conform or be put down. Don't get me wrong, there are lots of Americans who are wonderful, caring people, who would not harm a fly and see the injustice of the world and their own nation and hopefully want to put an end to those injustices. I must also add the point that Canada is not immune from the same abuse by or misuse of authority as our American neighbors. But then again, one could have said the same thing about the Germans under Hitler, the Russians under Stalin. And this brings us back to where I started. In a recent poll, the number of people who thought torture was okay in 2007 was around 40%. In a recent poll, that number was over 65%. I'm not really sure what that says, but all I can tell you is the U.S. ain't the nation she used to be, and the freedoms and liberty it once held so close, well, they seem tarnished, tattered, and rusty. And I feel sorry for my American neighbors. Anyhow, we'll return with a lot more stuff after this break.
Subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com.
This is the sound of compost and recyclables going into the garbage. Garbage that ends up in the landfill creating greenhouse gases. This is the sound of a more sustainable campus. You can make a difference when you sort it out. Learn more at sustain.ubc.ca/sortitout.
So President Barack Obama finally came out, I think, what is this, six, seven years into his presidency?
Six, yeah.
2 years into or 3 years into his second term, and he came out, what?
He's exhausted from prosecuting them.
Yes, yes. So Barack Obama didn't prosecute any of those war torture crimes. He never prosecuted anybody because Barack Obama said all those torture crimes happened in the past, and Barack Obama's looking towards the future. And when I heard that, I felt a lot better. You know why? Because all the crimes I've committed, they're in the past, too. Oh, I'm so glad we're not prosecuting past crimes anymore. I bet those people in prison are pissed off they committed their crimes in the future.
No, Jimmy, when I was a young man in New York City, and I was drinking back then, and I would go out at night and murder prostitutes. I was immature back then.
Also, when the cops would come arrest you, you'd be like, hey, I did that yesterday.
Yeah. Barack Obama finally came out, said we're torturing people. He said we tortured people, and well, here's what he said. Can I play it for you? Here's what he said. Okay, ready?
Sure. Even before I came into office, I was very clear that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we did some things that were wrong. We did a whole lot of things that were right, but we tortured some folks.
I like, but he's going to put the little caveat in. We did a lot of things that were right? We did a lot of things that were right. Okay, it was all right.
What did we do that was right? I don't remember that.
I got me too for it.
We started a gigantic war that cost us billions of dollars and killed thousands of innocent people. It's the wrong country. Where did we fit in something right in all that?
You got me, Frank. You got me, buddy. So, Harry, who goes on?
I think he just didn't want us to feel bad.
That's exactly right.
He doesn't want us to feel bad about the fact that we're just like the Nazis sometimes.
Yeah, we did some things right.
Sometimes.
Come on.
We did some things that were contrary to our values.
Oh.
I understand why it happened.
Yeah, you understand why it happened? Because we had some criminal motherfuckers running our government. That's why. Because they invaded a country for oil around a pack of lies. That's why. And then they tortured people to make them give information that was false, that said the Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein was working together. You mean that's why you understand? I don't think that's what you mean, right?
And they continue.
Because that's why it happened. That is why it happened. It wasn't that they were trying to get information. They were torturing people to make them say that Al-Qaeda was working with Saddam Hussein when they weren't. That's why you torture people, not to get information. You torture people so they say stuff that isn't true that
yeah,
you want them to say.
Jimmy, he said we did some things right. Okay.
So here he goes.
He says what did you say? It's understandable or...
You understand why it happened.
Understand. When in the wake of a crime does a policeman or does anyone say that? Well, this person was murdered. Look, I understand why it happened. Yeah. I have to arrest the person anyway. When does that nuance ever come into any kind of crime?
And by the way, murder, to me, it's like it's not a better analogy would be like rape, because, torture is like this heinous, horrible thing that has and then you're doing it intentionally on purpose. It's like rape. So I understand why the rape happened. You would never say that. But he's saying, I understand why torture happened. I understand why we turned into animals. That's what he's saying. Okay, let's go.
I think it's important when we look back to recall how afraid people were after the Twin Towers fell and the Pentagon had been hit and the plane in Pennsylvania had fallen and people did not know whether more attacks were imminent. And there was enormous pressure on our law enforcement and our national security teams to try to deal with this.
Yeah, so if your job is really tough, you get to commit war crimes. That's what he's saying.
Time to torture.
Yeah, so if your job is really, that's really what he's saying. He's saying if your job is hard, maybe you need to relax a little with some torture. Right? So if you're stressed, so a lot of times what happens in war, people get stressed, and a way to release it, you torture some people. So is that what he's saying? I think that's what he's saying. Okay.
I almost in a sense think it's worse than that because it's just like this complete abdication of leadership. Like, yeah, exactly. We were scared and we were terrified.
Right.
And there was enormous pressure.
That's why you have values.
That's why you have values and that's why you have leadership and smart people making those critical decisions. Because
right.
They were admittedly hard decisions. And you're allowed to be wrong, but you're not really allowed to be immoral.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Thank you, Ben.
But you know what? All those people in the Middle East are really bad.
Yeah. All right, so he's got a little bit more to say.
You know, it's important for us not to feel too sanctimonious in retrospect about the tough job that those folks had.
Yeah, that's exactly what you'd say to anyone responsible for heinous human crimes. You'd say, you know, in retrospect, don't give yourself such a hard time about it.
Yeah, he sounds like my therapist. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're afraid, you're under stress, torture relieves a lot of that pressure.
Yeah.
Is that what your therapist says?
Why is he talking? What was the point of this?
I don't. What did he think he was going to get out of this?
Yeah, I answer that? I think he doesn't want the torturers to have their feelings hurt.
You don't want to hurt the torch. Good point, Steph.
Instead of prosecuting Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Rice for their crimes, let's just hug it out with them.
Yeah, let's hug it out. Exactly. I like how he says, don't get sanctimonious.
Yeah, because, you know, waterboarding is bad, but sanctimony is really reprehensible.
Oh, I mean, Who hasn't waterboarded prisoners over 180 times, right? See, he who hasn't. Throw the first stone. That's what I say.
I would rather have an electrode attached to my balls than have someone be sanctimonious to me.
Oh.
In a heartbeat.
Don't be See, only the sanctimonious hold war criminals accountable, Ben. Hmm. Remember how sanctimonious they were at Nuremberg? Oh. I mean, they were so disgusting with the sanctimony, I almost kvetched.
They were so mean-spirited towards verbals.
Yes, they were. They were mean to him, and they were sanctimonious.
It's like
You have to remember the circumstances in which Nazism flourished and in which the Holocaust happened. It was a very tense time for Germans.
It was what?
Tense time.
Oh, it was a very tense time. I'm sorry.
Why, legitimately, from a political point of view, what was the point of this statement? Like, did Barack Obama wake up this morning and a couple of advisors come in and they say, you know, you haven't seemed really weak in weeks, you know? You know, it's nearly, it's August 6th and you haven't seemed like a giant pussy since June.
Exactly.
He said we tortured some folks with the same casualness, but he'd say we bought a zoo.
Yes, he did. You know, Frank, and I'm glad that we don't hold ourselves to a higher standard, or else we might have some sleepless nights about what we did. You know, other nations looking down their noses at us, thinking they're better than us just because they follow international law and don't torture prisoners held in jail for over a decade without a trial. You know what? They're just jealous. And sanctimonious. I'll tell you that, goddamn sanctimony. So there you go. That's his big... the reason why he came out and he had to talk about it, because there's that thing happening right now where the report's coming out, the CIA report on torture, and they redacted everything.
Yeah.
So what they did was... So the report is about who did torturing, who ordered torture, and where it happened, because it happened in foreign countries, didn't happen on our soil, and American agents acting in other countries. So that's important to know what countries it happened in, and it's important to know who did it and who ordered it. But what they did, what the CIA did, is they redacted, meaning they blacked out all the countries that were involved, all the people that were involved, even the names of the people who were tortured got blacked out. So basically...
That document was had more blacked out than Artie Lang, am I right?
The good news is that report's going to make an excellent Mad Lib.
So what you're basically left with is a report with no nouns. So it's just a bunch of verbs strung together.
Right.
This happened. Who did it? We don't know. Where it happened? I don't know. When? It's all blacked out. But just verbs of things happening. But they're not connected to anything. And again, that's our own CIA. The people who help to protect us, they also need to not be able to be honest with us, too. They're like another criminal organization trying to fight other criminals.
Maybe
that report was so hard to read, I thought it was a Cormac McCarthy novel.
Maybe if there's going to be an investigation and a report on crimes committed by the CIA, maybe you don't let the CIA have a look at it first.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
How about that? Yeah.
Oh, we can't say that.
You're supposed to deduce from his soothing tone that he's saying, don't worry, we're not going to prosecute anyone.
Yes, that's exactly what he's saying. So if, yeah.
That message has already been delivered.
Yeah, that's clear. That's clear.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
People have been torturing their fellow humans since the beginning of time, but it's only fairly recently that we turned against it. The German priest Anton Praetorius in the late 1500s protested strenuously against torture, but it was only with the coming of ideas about human rights that things began to change. Today we still torture, as we learned from Abu Ghraib, and states look for ever more refined legal arguments to defend extreme interrogation. This program is called Unspeakable Acts, and it's presented by Philip Coulter.
Torture in modern times took a giant leap forward during the years of the so-called Troubles in Northern Ireland in the 1960s and later. By 1971, the British government, fed up with the seemingly intractable problem of IRA violence, declared a policy of internment. Anyone could be arrested and held indefinitely without charge. At the same time, the British Army was anxious to experiment with new, more sophisticated interrogation techniques. And so on the night of August the 9th, 1971, 342 men were arrested in a series of raids across Northern Ireland. Of the 342 arrested on that night in Belfast, Jim Auld was one of 14 subjected to the five techniques: hooding, white noise, food and water deprivation, sleep deprivation, and forced standing, designed by the best lawyers and psychologists to be both legal and also tremendously effective in creating a kind of invisible, hopefully temporary, psychosis. In describing what happened to him, Jim Auld talks about how the pain of his torture took over his world, how it became the only thing in the world. In the words of Elaine Scarry, his world became unmade.
There was a hissing sound in the background, like the sound of an old television where the programs had been turned off, or a badly tuned radio. That sort of hiss loud, that hissing, continued, high-pitched hissing sound. And I remember the first time I noticed it, and I was saying, what is that noise? That's annoying. And from that point on, it appeared to get louder and louder and louder until it just invaded your head.
All day, every day?
Non-stop. Non-stop. It was just there. I remember I was trying to do addition tables. I was trying to spell words. I was trying multiplication tables, anything at all that I could think of in order to allow me to try and concentrate. And I couldn't do that. I just couldn't do it. And after about 4 days and nights of that, it comes a time when your body can't take any more, and it just collapses. You're just a heap, and you just collapse onto the floor. And after a while, believe it or not, the beatings were quite good, because the beatings they were giving you brought the circulation around. It started, you know, the circulation started flowing through your body, and the numbness and the pins and needles in your arms and legs lessened.
Are you saying to me that you started then to look forward to the beatings?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Because that brought the circulation around. Because the pain of your circulation not being able to move, it's a dreadful, dreadful pain whenever it goes on for so long. And the beatings at that stage, you could hardly feel them, because your body becomes that immune to it, that it feels like, while they were beating me with wooden batons, it felt like a rubber hose. You know, it was that sort of soft feeling. And at that stage, you get used to it, and I didn't particularly like it, but wasn't an awful lot I could do about it.
Was there a time, though, when you concluded that you needed to start talking, you needed to start saying something to these people?
Well, again, that's the whole process. If you're prepared to talk to them and tell them things, then you can stay off the wall. And I did. I told them anything at all. So they wanted to hear names, everybody that had ever been to school with, everybody that had ever worked with, everybody that had ever played football with. They were all top IRA men to me, because that kept me off the wall.
So you just started listing old schoolmates and saying they're in the IRA, or I played football with this fellow and he's in the IRA. Anything.
Anything at all. Anything at all to keep me out of that room, to keep me away from that noise.
And was there a part of your brain at the time going, I'll make this up to my friends later on, or I need you to try and help me understand, not so much the fact that you were trying to avoid the pain and the beatings and the walls, but what the consequences of this might be, or did you have even the capacity to think about that?
No, I didn't care. All I wanted was out of that room, for the pain to stop and to be left alone. And if I'd have known your name at the time, I can assure you, you'd have been an IRA man too.
Was this what finally led them to let you go then?
That was only part of it. What happened after that was I started hallucinating. And I don't know whether there was drugs in the water or whether it was how far my head had gone. And I was convinced at that stage that they had to kill me. Because the disgrace and the shame that they would face had it got out that this is what they had done to one of their own citizens would have brought the government down. And rather than it go on and them eventually kill me, I tried to kill myself. The building that I was in was clearly an old building. There was a 2-3 inch pipe ran along the bottom of the wall. I had fallen on it so many times I knew it intimately. But at that stage, I decided that if I could throw myself down onto this pipe, I could maybe break my neck and kill myself. And I tried. I threw myself down onto this pipe, and I cracked my head okay, but I cried because I didn't die. Because I thought that was the only way that I was getting out of that.
But they didn't kill you, they did let you go.
Well, they took 2 days to bring me back to normality. They brought me eventually off the wall into a room where there was a mattress on the floor. And they left me there. And then there was a plainclothes cop came in, and he massaged my hands and my arms and my back to try and get the circulation going. He fed me soup to try and build me up. And he washed me. He washed me from head to toe, because I couldn't lift my hands to wash myself. I was just a blubbering wreck in the corner crying. And he washed me and he dressed me. I thought he was God.
And when you see the kinds of techniques that are used at these prisons that are being used today, do you see a direct link to what you went through?
Exactly the same links. There's the softening up process. That's the same techniques of isolation, of depriving them of their senses, of making them feeling that they've nothing worth living for. And clearly that's what was happening. What's happening in America is the follow-on from that.
Jim, you tell the story of that experience in the prison today with such chilling clarity. I'm wondering, were you always able to tell the story?
Oh God, no. When I came out of prison at that stage, I just went wild. I just went mad. I went drinking. I was seriously on drink for about 10 years, and it took me that time to come to my senses. But I was out of control for about 10 years. I had to leave Ireland, the north of Ireland. I moved away from home, away from everybody, until I could sleep at night, until I could have a sleep without crying, where I could face up to the people whose names I had given to the police, and I know some of them were arrested and beaten as well, and that was all down to me.
How long did that period of recovery take?
About 10 years. I can tell you now, the water is running down the side of my head now. I haven't told it. That was regular happening to me. When I told the story to anybody, for weeks after it, I would have nightmares. I would have night terrors. I would waken up. Early on, I went on the drink for 3 or 4 weeks before I could get myself settled down. And it's only this past lot of years that I've been able to tell it without it having any serious effect.
Although when I listen to you tell the story, still I hear a catch in your voice when you're describing what they were doing to you.
What I can't understand is how one human being could do that to another. It just appalls me. And what frightens me even more is that people in government who are supposed to be looking after our welfare can do that to other human beings and say that they're doing it on behalf of me.
I'm just looking at this list of things that they did to you, Jim. Hooding, the wall standing, the noise, the sleep deprivation, the taking away food. How did the torture that you went through change you?
I supported wholly the IRA's campaign against Britain. I will support the IRA's campaign against Britain forever.
Sympathetic to their use of violence?
Very much so.
Did you ever take part in any of it yourself?
No, I didn't, and that's because I'm a coward. Had I had more courage, I would have.
You said you were a coward.
So, yeah. But for the volunteers, the men and women of the IRA, I have the utmost respect.
So then the torture, in fact, turned you into what they were accusing you of in the first place?
Very much so.
So here we are now, 35 years later, looking at the same kind of treatment, the same kind of torture unfolding in different countries, at different places, with different countries involved. Tell me what goes through your mind when you see the pictures from Abu Ghraib, you hear the stories from Guantanamo Bay, and you hear the explanations coming from the American authorities who are rationalizing it.
I just see it as a pack of lies. Just a pack of lies. I just think it's appalling. There's something drastically wrong when a democracy has to torture and kill people for their own good.
I'm not going to try and carry the water for the people who make these kinds of decisions, but I'm thinking of the time in the early 70s when there was a belief in London that the IRA was such a dangerous group of people that any tactic was justifiable. And I'm thinking of 9/11 and the belief that exists in this country that unless something is done to stop the terrorist, then the country is at risk. And the something, even if it means torture, might be good for the nation, the world, in the long run.
No, I think that's seriously a flawed way of looking at things. The IRA were a small group in Ireland in 1971. The prison that I went into, there were initially 342 people. Of those, there might have been about 50 of them IRA. By 1975, there were thousands of IRA men and women, all of them willing to take up arms and explosives to kill British soldiers. And 9/11 was an appalling act of savagery, an appalling act of savagery. But I think that it is incremental. If they were prepared to do that then, the new recruits into those organisations who have been through Guantanamo Bay and those other torture chambers, what are they going to be prepared to do? I have absolutely no doubt that it is creating a monster that neither America nor anywhere else will be able to control.
stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
The argument that you can't argue with here, the rhetoric side of this, right, that you would know if you took the courses, that there are shutdown places in an argument. And the shutdown place on the argument about this militarized equipment for the police is, yeah, but it saves lives. You want police officers to go into these situations less protected. Boom. What if it even saves one child? Boom. Those are argument shutdown points. Takes the debate and shuts it down because, of course, none of us wants to, you know, see an officer get hurt, right? And you can argue all day long against the if it only saves one child's life argument, but then the comeback, and it's a good one, is, well, what if it's your child? Bingo, right? Game over. I'll let you all go Nazi to save my kid's life, sorry. Argument over, right? They can be the Gestapo if it saves my kid's life, but you can't run a society that way. Because all the rest of our children will be grievously affected if you do. The question is, you know, how do you get around the idea that to demilitarize the police might mean you lose more police, right? That's the overriding argument here. And it's the logical reason, if you're a pessimist, to say this is why it's not going to change. Because at this point in time, there is no argument, no counter-argument that's good enough to combat that. There's a, and you know, the funny thing is too, is that a lot of police officers who are retired now see this very clearly. They're some of the biggest critics of all this, right? Because they remember doing much of the same stuff without this equipment, right? They, in their minds, they're thinking, okay, here's how you handle that. And by the way, I've heard some of these guys say that because we have all this modern stuff, right, this war surplus, for lack of a better word, they've allowed some of the traditional police officer's skills to erode, that a lot of these old-timers say, well, you know, this is how we would have handled it 30 years ago, blah, blah, blah. Although I know a few old-timers who would have said, well, 30 years ago, we'd take them behind a building and beat the hell out of them. You just don't know, right? I've seen all sides of the police officers, and I've seen them from all sides. They're people, okay? And a lot of them are really good people and really brave people, but they're people. And sometimes you get these departments. This should be pointed out, too, and we've talked about this before. I mean, L.A.'s Signal Hill Police Department was famous, right, for a generation. But you get this culture that develops in some of them, especially some of the smaller ones, where, you know, four or five significant officers can color the whole feel of a place. And slowly but surely, people who feel differently drop out and leave. And the people who stay are the people that either think the same or can be, you know, convinced to think the same. And you sometimes get these police departments where the locals, like maybe these people in Ferguson, will say for years, you have no idea what this police force is like. You have no idea what it's like to live under here. And then somebody gets shot six times, regardless of the circumstances, and boom. Things go up in flames. And then the state comes in with flashbang grenades and tear gas and armored personnel vehicles, and they point their high-powered weapons at the crowd. I'd be pissed, too. I'm sorry. Listen, police officers, you have a hard job. You ought to be fired if you point an automatic weapon at a crowd. You ought to be fired. I have an AP article here by, this is Tammy Abdullah and Eric Tucker from August 16, 2014. And in it, you know, they give sort of the counter view, right, which is important to give. I think they interview Los Angeles County Sheriff's Chief Bill McSweeney, right, and he heads the detective division, it says. And he says, quote, is it smart for them, meaning the police in Missouri, to use that stuff, meaning the militarized gear, and perhaps look like soldiers from Iraq going into a place? Is that smart or over the top? I'd say generally that's smart. Now, if you use that every time a guy is writing a bad check, well, then that gets rather extreme. And then he says, and this is the good point, right? Quote, it's tempting to say, shouldn't we wear these things? Shouldn't we approach this as if we could get shot, he said? How do you say no to that question? End quote. Exactly right. How do you say no to that question? But that question has gotten us into a position where the amount of goods transferred through the government program that allows the war gear to filter down to your local law enforcement, which was doing $1 million of transfer in 1990, did $450 million in transfers last year. And as somebody quoted in this AP article, David Harris, a police expert at the University of Pittsburgh Law School, said, quote, "Every police force of any size in this country has access to those kinds of weapons now. It makes it more likely to be used and is an escalation all by itself," end quote. And lest you think they only bring this stuff out, you know, for the important situations like giant riots, the story says, quote, "In Louisiana, masked police in full body armor carrying AR-15 assault rifles raided a nightclub without a warrant, looking not for terrorists, but for underage drinkers and fire code violations. Officers in California train using the same counterinsurgency tactics as those that are used in Afghanistan." End quote. Again, I don't know how you get this stuff out of the hands of the police officers overall. I'm not even sure sometimes you would want them out of the hands. But I would say this, they are frighteningly uncontrolled, all right? If you want to say that, you know, under circumstances A, B, C, or D, we can unlock the vault and pull out the armored personnel carrier and the military gear, we have a hostage situation down at the mall, okay, pull out the gear, right? Not, we think there might be a little weed growing in that person's backyard. Throw a flashbang grenade in the room, you know, do a no-knock and go in there before they can dispose of the evidence. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You shouldn't get to use the tank for that. And if you say, well, listen, that guy could have a gun and an officer could go down, what is the price that we pay to not look like we have the army out there on the street? I mean, come on. I mean, you may call it a public relations move when there are lives at stake, Dan, but come on. If you have the army patrolling the streets, you can say all day long that it's totally benign. But if you think the people in Ferguson, Missouri are going to look at you like the friendly policeman on the street corner instead of the armed occupiers, you're deluding yourselves. If you look like armed occupiers and you keep arresting the locals, how do you think the kids growing up in that community are going to see you? Now, you may say, listen, Dan, I'm not here to be liked. I'm here to enforce the laws. Yes, well, do you enforce the laws looking like you work for the people in that community? Or do you enforce the laws looking like you work from some outside entity that the people in that community see themselves as victims of? I mean, truthfully, the time when the situation de-escalated and got the most peaceful was when the helmets came off and the guns came down and the police mingled with the crowd, right? I hate to sound all kumbaya about it, but that kind of says we're on the same side, whereas the other approach kind of says you're on your side, I'm on my side, and I have my guns, and they're pointed at you. Oh, and by the way, your taxes pay my salary. I'm sorry, there's a total disconnect there, and I'm sorry that the politicians are so gutless about it. You want to tweet that you're against that shocks you, then you get up there, and you make the very courageous and difficult-to-make argument that we might lose more police officers if we don't have tanks rolling up on every potential call that might potentially have a gun, but that there's a value to that. We are protecting the civil nature of our society. That's worth something, folks. And listen, I can understand if an officer thinks to themselves, Dan, you're crazy. I'm not gonna put my life in danger so that you can feel good about some PR move. That's fine. My suggestion to you would be, maybe you should find another line of work.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, Torture Edition.
Anything to say about the militarization of the police department, anybody?
Yes.
Yes.
I think if Eisenhower were alive today, I think the first thing he would do is amend his final speech and say that the military-industrial complex will also come for community policing. And if you want an example of that, go and look. There's a book about the Glock firearm that talks about how that firearm manufacturer basically Jedi mind-tricked every police force in this country into buying Glocks. And they happily did it.
Yes.
And so what's happened is that police forces have become pawns of a military-industrial complex.
Yes. So those cops in Ferguson, Missouri, were driving what they call a Marvac. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Yes, anyway, it's designed to go over landmines.
You can go over a landmine with it.
Wait, landmines or landmimes?
No, landmine.
Oh, okay. I thought
both.
You were talking about the circus performers.
Both.
I
know.
No.
Which
both.
Are equally just as offensive.
No, yeah. It doesn't have protection against those.
Okay, no one does.
No, you could perform Del Arte in front of them and you're
so
dead.
So it won't break through the invisible walls that they built?
Damn. Yeah.
I don't know. I thought that guy in the LeBron James t-shirt might have sort of mined the intersection there.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It's a good possibility.
Let me just say, so the MARVAC didn't exist before the Iraq War. It was developed during the Iraq War specifically to deal with IEDs.
Really?
That is how intense a machine this thing is.
You know a lot of stuff. No, that's good. That is amazing, right? And so now it went that quickly from the battlefield to
Main
Street.
Yes, because what happens, and this is so infuriating, but basically when arms designers, build a gun, build a tank, build whatever, they are selling it to the government almost at cost.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So what they do is they immediately turn around and see if they can find a civilian market for it. That's why the Hummer became a thing. That's why handguns such as the Beretta M9 became so popular in the civilian market.
Really?
And the reason is specifically because that development costs a lot of money. They're recouping as much profit as they can out of those designs.
But, you know, it's not – I get the development costs some amount of money. This is not a cancer drug that needs to be taken through years of trial. I mean, the Beretta 9 – it was not completely dissimilar from the Beretta 8. I know that wasn't it, but I mean, it's still gun technology that was already kind of in place.
You're absolutely right.
I think they should get rid of the Beretta 9, and that's the name of that too.
You're mixing Telus and Valis, I think.
You know, I just want to highlight, I was reading...
Who loves you, baby?
I was reading this article that's highlighting the different ways that we're militarizing our country.
Yeah.
And I thought this was really interesting because they highlighted how... a recent New York Times article by Matt Apuzzo reported that in the Obama era, police departments have received tens of thousands of machine guns.
Machine guns.
Nearly 200,000 ammunition magazines, thousands of pieces of camouflage, which we're seeing in Missouri.
Yes.
And night vision equipment, and hundreds of silencers.
Silencers.
Armored
cars. Why do cops need silencers?
And aircraft. And they go on to say, the result is that the police agencies around the nation possess military-grade equipment, turning officers who are supposed to fight crime and protect community into what looks like invading forces from an army. And military-style police raids have increased in recent years, with one count putting the number at 80,000 such raids last year. And what they ultimately are doing are they're transforming neighborhoods into war zones.
Yes.
And these neighborhoods turn out to be people of color.
In the councils of government.
If you're wondering what it feels like to have a mine-resistant vehicle on the streets of your town, I give you a YouTube video of two dudes from Saginaw, Michigan.
Holy shit, dude. Super armored, dude. Damn, look, he doesn't want anybody to see him in there.
Dude, you can't even see him.
Damn.
That's crazy. Saginaw County Sheriff, dude. It looks cool, dude. Look how big these tires are compared to our... It's taller than... It's, dude.
That's awesome!
Now, to be fair, that is exactly how they reacted when a Chipotle first opened there. But the point is, listen carefully as one of them suddenly realizes something.
Damn, dude, that's f***ed up. Why? Has our city gotten that f***ing bad?
Here's the thing. No. It hasn't got that bad. Because unless you live in downtown Kabul, there is no practical need for anything like that in your town. Just ask the people that it came from.
The Army itself, actually, in a newsletter a few months ago, recommended against using MRAPs, even at U.S. military bases, you know, on paved streets in the United States. They're actually unsafe. They tear up the streets. They have a high rollover potential.
Exactly. The only vehicle that should be tearing up the streets of Saginaw is Chad's souped-up Honda Civic. Dude! Dude, my car is sick, dude! The police are not soldiers. So why, in this photo from Ferguson, are they wearing fucking camo? They are northwest of St. Louis, not northwest of the Amazon. If they want to blend in with their surroundings, they should be dressed as a dollar store. And also, look in the photo at where their guns are pointed. If you were actually in the military, you would know that you are not supposed to do that.
In the military, we're trained on something called escalation of force, which basically means the only time that you're really going to point a weapon directly at someone is when you're ready to pull the trigger. And instead of that, we've seen in Ferguson that police are just wandering around with their weapons up at all times, pointing them at people that obviously didn't pose a threat.
Well, they don't currently pose a threat, but, you know, it's really all about what they might do. Now, they could, for instance, join the police, be given a gun they're not trained to use properly, and then wander around pointing it at people. That would be fucking terrifying. The point is, if you are a cop in the United States, you should dress for the job you have, not the job you want. Because if you have all this equipment, it's going to go to your head. Thanks in part to this kind of access to military hardware, there has been a massive rise in both the number and the use of police department SWAT teams.
The number of SWAT raids have gone up by 1,400% since the 1980s. An estimated 50,000 now take place every year.
Just keep that clip in mind when I tell you that 79% of SWAT deployments are now for executing search warrants, and most of those were for drug investigations. So yes, if you are getting high in your dorm room right now, you are not paranoid. There is a SWAT team outside, and they are coming to get you. All of which brings us back to this week and to Ferguson. So how do you improve things there? Well, you could demilitarize the police force to stop things looking like this, but that would just change the optics. The substance of the problem would still be there, as was embodied by a police officer on the streets of Ferguson this week, who was dressed entirely normally.
Bring it! Are you f***ing in? Bring it!
The phrase, bring it, you f***ing animals, is barely acceptable during a zoo escape. It's not even acceptable in the restaurant in Mary Poppins where penguins are waiters. Bring it, you f***ing animal! Hey, don't treat them like that. They'll piss in your soup. They'll piss in your soup. And you'll deserve it. That kind of statement betrays an inability to see the citizens of Ferguson as individuals and instead treats them as a threatening whole. And that is a top-down problem, because last night, this is how the governor of Missouri decided to try and rebuild trust between the police and the community.
I signed an order declaring a state of emergency and ordering the implementation of a curfew in the impacted area of Ferguson.
Oh, perfect. So you took a community tired of being treated as criminals and imprisoned them all in their own houses for a night. And in doing so, employed the tone of a pissed off vice principal trying to restore order at an assembly.
But if we're going to achieve justice, we must first have and maintain peace. This is a test. The eyes of the world are watching.
That is profoundly patronizing. Look, let's see if you can all remain quiet for 20 minutes, and then we'll see if you can all go and play outside. If even the governor can't distinguish between the good and the bad elements of the community, and has decided to punish everyone equally, then that should go both ways. I know the police love their ridiculous, unnecessary military equipment, so here's another patronizing test. Let's take it all away from them, and if they can make it through a whole month without killing a single unarmed black man, then, and only then, can they get their fucking toys back.
That's all we have time for this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on. And torture's bad.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com.
and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
To the stars, a still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose, a morning filled with 400 billion suns, the rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.